I like the dialogue on a television show called Designing Women, so I watch occasionally. Recently, one of the four women had to make a speech, but she felt no passion about it, so she asked another of the women to get angry and talk so that she could see how to make an effective speech. It is true that we sometimes make the best speech of our lives when we get angry, especially if we are angry for some good reason. But it is also true that we sometimes make the worst speech of our lives in terms of harm done when we explode, which is why somebody said, "Speak when you're angry, and you'll make the best speech you'll ever regret." One of the reasons, of course, is that we say things when we're angry that we're much too smart to say any other time. We reveal things we never intended to reveal, which again is why Henry Ward Beecher, a great old Congregational minister, gave such a grim piece of advice one time. He said, "Never forget what a man says to you when he is angry," the assumption being that in such a state, he'll tell you how he really feels. We're talking about the second of the seven deadly sins, a list put together by the medieval church, and not necessarily the list we might make, but still interesting and useful. There is probably no one in this room who has not said at least once, "I got mad the other day and made a fool of myself." I know the English teacher used to tell us to say angry instead of mad, but she was only half right. Some anger is temporary madness. Otherwise, a man I know would never have kicked the bumper of his car and broken his foot. Fortunately for most of us, anger shows up a little less often as we get older, but it certainly starts early, as I will demonstrate in a moment. The first thing to say about anger is that it is not always bad. There are times when it would be wrong not to be angry. The most annoying image of Jesus is the one that has him made of skimmed milk and lukewarm water. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, a safe toy for sentimental preachers and prim and proper parishioners who would tremble before a man of real passion. He was gentle most of the time and disciplined, but he was not a man you could trifle with. Watch him turn over the tables of the money changers in the temple grounds. Listen when he calls some of the city's leading people hypocrites and rattlesnakes, and you'll understand why there were people who didn't like him, who hated what he was doing enough, finally, to want him dead. He could get angry, all right. And the anger was the kind that makes the eyes shoot fire and the face turn red. But he was never angry because of some wrong done to him. Always because of wrong done to some ideal he cherished or some injustice done to other people. Let that kind of anger die out of the world, and society would rot from the roots up in a hurry. It's the kind of anger one of the great prophets felt when he wrote, "My wrath upheld me." I like people who get angry about unfairness, about phoniness and pretense, about the cruelties practiced upon the weak by those who are strong. What an enormous debt we owe that kind of anger. But let's talk about the other kind, the kind that found its way into the list of the seven deadly sins, the kind most of us know far better than we do the good kind. There are two forms of harmful anger, the blazing kind and the brooding kind. Some of us are like gunpowder. The least spark sets off an explosion. We kick a fender, throw a dish, punch somebody in the nose. Some of us do that. Most of us don't because we're too sophisticated for a physical assault. We use a deadlier weapon. We shoot words tipped with poison. One of the ugliest sights on earth can be an angry person, verbally superior, impaling some helpless victim on the thorns of the sharpest and nastiest words in his arsenal. This form of anger does not even require that the victim be present. Vicious things can be said behind the victim's back, and those who hear will repeat them everywhere they go, sort of like spreading a plague by sending carriers through a city. And the victim is helpless, doesn't even know she's being poisoned, unable to mount a defense until it's too late. The other kind of anger is brooding. Silent and sullen, we pout over a wrong done to us, real or imagined. I suppose I'm not alone in preferring to face someone whose temper flares and quickly subsides, bad as that may be, to someone who goes about nursing a grudge for weeks and months. The hot flash of anger may be less destructive, finally, than a slow-burning resentment. I think of a real person under the fictitious name of Jane, who once in another church suddenly stopped speaking to me unless absolutely forced. Subtle attempts to find out what was wrong failed until I discovered by accident that she had misinterpreted a comment made during a sermon. It took only a few minutes to convince her of the mistake, and we were friends again. But if she had come up to me with an angry face moments after the imagined insult and told me off, I could have explained, and we could have saved 2 years that were lost forever to our friendship. May we be delivered in our homes, in our work, and in our church from people who breastfeed their anger in the privacy of a closet. When we look at the causes of anger, especially the blazing kind, the list is long. The merest trifles can throw us into a rage. We're late and a shoelace breaks. I knew a man who slammed his fist clear through a wall one day because a malevolent shoelace broke when he was in a hurry. The traffic light turns green and the guy in the car ahead of us is sitting there daydreaming. Okay if we're fresh and not in a hurry, devastating if we're hot and tired. I have surprised myself at times by holding my temper in check in a very difficult moment when the issue was truly important, and then turning around and losing it over the silliest trifle you can imagine. I think of that memorable day some years ago when I was on the way home about 5 from the university, fed up with the tedium and inanities of 3 straight committee meetings in a row and a car roared up behind me, honking furiously so the driver could pass. I couldn't do anything because of traffic in front of me, but the car crowded my back bumper and honked some more, and finally swung angrily out around me when there was a momentary break. When the driver glared at me, my response was absolutely adolescent. Digital, in fact. The fact that he turned out to be one of my parishioners didn't help things. What silly, silly things we do sometimes when the grown-up self is no longer in control. One of the causes of uncontrolled anger for some of us is that it worked so well in childhood. I know a young woman whose disposition is serene and tolerant beyond almost anyone I've ever met. Yet I recall one day when at about 3, she stretched out in the aisle of a crowded supermarket and let go with the noisiest temper tantrum you ever saw in your life. Her mother and I walked off and left her. And while we were buying the spinach, she decided that it was a pretty silly business to kick your legs in the air and scream when your parents weren't even around to notice. If it had worked, would she have tried it again? And if it had worked often, would she be tempted to try it once in a while now with her family? I know a child, not a relative this time, who comes from a home where his parents never oppose him. Now he is discovering that his teacher sometimes does, or that his playmates refuse to do what he tells them to do. He doesn't know how to handle that kind of situation, so he flies into a rage. Some people never get over that. They just learn more sophisticated ways of manipulating people when they get angry. Sometimes it's just the lack of a sense of humor that makes us get angry over trifles. Really bad-tempered people, I think, are always humorless, juiceless folk who take themselves too seriously. I thought a great old black minister had the right cure for that. If you could just sit on the fence, he said, and see yourself pass by, you'd die laughing at the sight. I really think that if you've never looked in the mirror and laughed at the absurdity that is you, you are in deep trouble. Once in a while, you have to do that. I remember the girl who told me that her parents hadn't spoken to each other for several weeks and were communicating only by notes passed through their children. She said they had quarreled over whether a certain couple should be invited to dinner. What a humorless pair they must have been to drag that insanity along for so many weeks. What a great blessing it is to have a friend or to be married to a person who has a sense of the absurdities of life and can laugh. We get angry out of frustrations. A Chinese proverb says the man who is losing the argument strikes the first blow. We get angry because we hurt. And we feel in some kind of blind illogic that if we can hurt someone else, we'll feel better. Simone Weil has described how when she was suffering from acute migraine, she actually wanted to hit someone on the very spot where she felt the pain. Somebody has said control of temper is 9/10 of Christianity. It may be true. John Wesley, and I've never admired him more than in this comment, put it this way, and if you've drifted at all, please come back for a moment, because this is a marvelous comment and it requires your careful listening. I find, he said, I find more profit in sermons on either good tempers or good works than in what are commonly called gospel sermons. That term has now become a piece of mechanical piety. Let but a pert, self-sufficient animal, if you think of some TV evangelists, I cannot stop you. Let but a pert, self-sufficient animal that has neither sense nor grace bawl out something about Christ or his blood or justification by faith, and his hearers will cry out, "What a fine gospel sermon." Nonsense, says Wesley. What really needs stress is a command like this: let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. He knew what people needed to hear, how to control temper. And he also knew that it's easier, a great deal easier for some of us than it is for others. Some of us almost seem born good-natured or made so by a wonderful environment. Others have a prickly temper, a family characteristic. It almost seems, I think, of a minister rebuked for being a little quick on the trigger, who said to his rebuker, "Young man, I control more temper in every 15 minutes than you will in your whole lifetime." He could be telling the truth. Some people haven't much temper to control. A sermon like this is only a mild curiosity to them because the problem seems so remote. But some of us, notice the pronoun, have paid the price of temper more than once, and for us the problem is very real. So what can we do about it? Can we control our temper? I think the honest answer has to be often yes. I know we rationalize by saying, "I couldn't help myself." And if we let ourselves go past a certain point, that's true. We have to know where our point of no return is and stay behind it. If that means leaving the party early or hurrying out of the committee meeting to avoid an explosion, it would pay us to do it. But our rationalizations are not always honest. Consider the little boy who was so angry with his mother and so ugly to her and later said, "I couldn't help it." Someone asked him if he ever lost his temper toward his teacher in school. He said no, and was asked why not. "Because I don't want her to dislike me." So you see, he had done what many of us do to the people closest to us. He had presumed on the love of his mother, expecting her to like him no matter how he behaved, but because he still felt he had to win or hold the affection of his teacher, he kept himself under control. When we're thinking, and when we care enough, we probably can too.